I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Her roots are here in Kansas City, but these days Sarah McCammon spends her time in the Mid-Atlantic and Southeastern states as a correspondent for NPR. Today, McCammon is back in her hometown and in our studio to tell us where her roots in public radio got started, what it's like to cover emotional beats, and how she's managed to get people to talk to her about some pretty private topics. Then, Kansas City municipal elections are Tuesday, so we're revisiting our conversations with mayoral candidates Jolie Justice and Quentin Lucas. You can hear their plans for the city if elected mayor. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Sarah McCammon knows where the action is, a correspondent on the national desk for NPR. McCammon has been front and center reporting on one of the hottest issues in the country these days, and that's abortion and the new efforts to restrict the procedure in many states across the country. She's also reported on the horrific shootings in Virginia Beach. Today, she's back in her old hometown in Kansas City for KCUR's annual Radioactive Gala, where she's the featured speaker. And for those of you who won't be hearing her tonight, we've got her right here, right now for you. Sarah McCammon's work for NPR focuses on the political, social, and cultural divides in America, including abortion and reproductive rights, and the intersections of politics and religion. During the 2016 election cycle, she was NPR's lead political reporter assigned to the Donald Trump campaign. Sarah, welcome home. So nice to have you here.
Yeah, it's so good to be here. Thank you.
What part of town did you grow up in?
I grew up in kind of South Kansas City. So near the state line, really just not far from state line at all, on the Missouri side, but kind of close to Leawood and Overland Park.
So what have you missed most about your old hometown here?
You know, it's funny. It's probably a weird thing to say, but I kind of miss just like the way the air feels.
Really?
which is probably more about how everything looks, how open everything is. Every time I come back here, or really anywhere in the Midwest, it's like I just kind of breathe a sigh of relief because it's just a little bit more chill. It's a little bit more calm.
Yeah.
Definitely miss the property value, the cost of living. But it's funny. I was looking out this morning from my hotel over downtown Kansas City and thinking, oh, it's so nice and open.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
there's all this space. And I heard a couple of guys from out of town go, oh, there's not much going on. And I said, you know, you really just have to know where to go. Yeah. So I'm very, very protective
of Kansas
City.
Still. Yeah. Well, usually people answer Winstead's or Gates Barbecue, but you're saying the air.
Yeah.
It just feels better.
And the space.
Easy. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the first thing you wanted to do when you got back in town?
Well, see people I love, and I'm going to be seeing some of them this weekend, and I got to catch up with a friend yesterday. So
that's all good.
Yeah, that's what home is ultimately all about, right?
Well, I wanted to ask you about some news that broke yesterday that you reported on for NPR. It was the news about White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders leaving her post. She's obviously had a rocky relationship with the White House press corps. How will her tenure be remembered?
I think it will be remembered much like, I mean, it's indicative of the relationship between the press and the White House and President Trump himself at large, which is just the tension and the sort of kind of bitter relationship. Sarah, you know, I was in that press briefing room with Sarah a number of times last summer when I filled in for White House correspondent Tamara Keith while she was out being a mom a new mom for a few months. It was always an adventure. I know I can't really compare. I wasn't a White House correspondent in previous administrations, so I don't have firsthand anything to compare it to. But, you know, I remember really struggling to get questions answered and to get a clear response. And, you know, I mean, Sarah could be civil and polite at times, but also very aggressive, I think you could say, in terms of her interactions with the press. And
she was in such a no-win situation because the president is sort of his own communications director, right? I mean, and she's sort of there to try to fill in some gaps that maybe she didn't even know how to fill them in at times.
Yeah, I think clearly that has been a difficult job, right? The president has gone through multiple communications directors and spokespeople in just a couple of years as president now, right? So and his relationship to the press. We'll talk more about that tonight at this event for anybody who's going to be there. But his relationship with the press is, at least as long as he's been a political figure, has been pretty strained. And
right.
I think it's just a reflection of that.
Well, he tweeted yesterday, the president did, that he hopes that Sarah Sanders runs for governor of Arkansas. She would be fantastic, he said. Does she have political ambitions that we know about?
I haven't asked her, but clearly her father, Mike Huckabee, was a former governor of Arkansas, very active still in politics, on social media and cable news, and somebody who hasn't faded away in terms of the political conversation. And so it wouldn't be surprising, right? We've seen many, many families on both sides of the aisle sort of go on to have almost kind of political dynasties, and
right.
voters aren't always crazy about that, but they do seem to, you know, they do seem to reelect people from the same family quite a bit. And who knows, maybe Sarah will do that. She says she's going to spend time with her family. I think she has three children who are pretty young. So I certainly understand that. But no doubt she'll probably do other things as well.
NPR national correspondent Sarah McCammon is my guest. You know, your interest in politics began when you were a kid. At least that's what I read. Here in Kansas City, you would tape on a VCR because, yeah, you're that old.
I'm
now.
Old enough, yeah.
Yeah, the Sunday morning talk shows, and you'd watch them later that day with your dad. Where did your interest in politics come from?
You know, in my house, we were not really that into sports. I went to a school where everybody was into the Chiefs and the Royals. And, you know, of course, I would root for them, especially the Royals. But we just, you know, it wasn't a priority in our household. Really, things like our faith and what was going on in sort of current events and politics, we talked about that way more than we talked about things like sports or entertainment.
But most kids still don't watch the Sunday morning talk shows.
You know, my parents were very strict, and there wasn't a lot of TV I was allowed to watch.
begins to explain it a little bit.
I remember in fourth or fifth grade, the teacher asking us, I don't remember why, but asking us all like to list our favorite TV shows for some class project, and everybody was like, you know, Family Matters. And
you said Meet the Press.
And I said the news.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. It was sort of like forced nerddom, but I guess it's worked out for me.
In 1998, you spent a semester serving as a U.S. Senate page, and somewhere along the way, I saw a photograph of you, which I assume was taken that year, with Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. That must have been a kick.
Yeah, that was very cool. Yeah, so some people listening will remember former Senator Kit Bond.
Yes.
From Missouri, longtime senator.
Covered him for many years.
And I was a page for him in 1998 when I was 17, so now you know how old I am. and that was an incredible experience. I had, you know, lived all of my life in Kansas City, had gone to a small private Christian school, had, you know, been fairly sheltered, I would say, and then to go, you know, to D.C. and be around all these famous people and kids from all over the country who had really different lives from me, different religions,
yeah.
different cultures. It was really, pivotal experience for me. And what happened that day was actually I was sick. I think it was in the spring of 98, and I had stayed home, taken a sick day, but felt a little better, so I decided to come into work at the Capitol. And I'm in that picture. I'm wearing my little page
yes.
uniform,
yes.
the blue suit, and I was literally walking up the steps to the Senate side, which is an area you can't go unless you have a special pass, but I did because I was a page, and. Yes, former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was walking down the steps, and I said, Ms. O'Connor? And she said, yes. I said, can I get a picture with you? Because I just happened to have my camera because it was during cherry blossom time. So I thought, I'll take some pictures of the cherry blossoms as I walk over. It was incredible. It was just a brief meeting, but, you know, to see the first female Supreme Court justice as
there
a
you
young
were.
Woman, it was unforgettable.
Well, moments like that can light up someone's life and maybe steer them in a certain direction, and maybe to some degree it did you too.
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely, it's inspiring, right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, even, I guess I'm like as old as you can be and be a millennial, but even even at my age, there aren't, you know, there still are not a ton of women in office. And when I was younger, even fewer. There still hasn't been a female president. And so to see a woman like that who was really accomplished and had made it that far, you know, in that world was really,
cool.
I think, just really inspiring.
You know, you've mentioned already here this morning you were raised in a conservative Christian family. Here in your family, you later realized fit the definition of evangelical, even though your family didn't use that word. What church was it? And tell us just a little bit.
We went to this church out in Shawnee Mission. I don't even know if it exists anymore, called Full Faith Church of Love South, yeah, which you might guess from the title was, I think, a lot of ex-hippies who'd kind of found Jesus in the 70s. It was a big part of my childhood. And no, we didn't use words like evangelical. We didn't, you know, we just called ourselves Christians. But growing up in that way, I think it definitely shaped me. And I'm grateful for the strong community that I grew up around. And I think it does help me understand a little bit more about kind of American politics these days, because it was sort of like a firsthand experience of a culture and a community that's become very influential in American politics.
You know, like a lot of teenagers, though, at some point, and maybe it was the budding journalist in you began rebelling a little bit, asking lots of questions. I mean, that can be difficult to do in any family, maybe just as much so in conservative faith traditions. How did that go for you?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call it rebelling. I think I always had very deep and sincere interest in my faith and in understanding the world and in trying to figure out what was true and what was right. And I think that's actually a value that comes from, for me, from faith, from Christianity. Not to say it's exclusive to that, certainly.
Right.
But I think about freshman year of high school, I was actually not rebellious at all. I was a very good student. I followed all the rules. And,
you began asking questions.
But I began asking questions. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was not to pat myself too hard on the back, but I was kind of a model firstborn child. I was very, very well behaved. But I had a lot of questions. And I wanted to understand sort of what I had been taught and try to make sense of the world. And I think everything from, what I was taught about science to politics to a whole lot of other things. And I think in some ways becoming a journalist is just an extension of that exploration, because as journalists, ultimately what we're doing is we are trying to observe and gather data, and we are talking to people with all kinds of different points of view and life experiences. And if we're doing our jobs well, trying to represent them accurately, sensitively, fairly. And for me, I think I've just always been naturally a curious person, a questioner, somebody who didn't necessarily want to accept everything that I was told by whoever it may be. And I think that is a trait that has probably a lot of why I went into journalism, because it's about questioning authority, you know, questioning what you think you know, trying to figure out if something is really true. But I think it's important to do it respectfully and thoughtfully. And so, I try to synthesize all of that, I guess, in the way I do my work.
NPR Sarah McCammon is my guest. She's a national correspondent for the network. So when did the journalistic bell begin ringing in your head? When did that start?
Probably in middle school. And I have to credit my parents. Like, as much as they were very conservative, they also, they took me to meet my Democratic Representative Karen McCarthy at the time.
Okay.
It would have been 1995, I think, four or five. I went to Washington, D.C. as part of the National Christian School Spelling Bee because I was that cool. And so we went and met our lawmakers of both parties.
Yeah.
And this is something I think parents, by the way, if you're taking your kids to D.C., regardless of whether you like your representative or your senator, ask for a meeting with them. Meet them. Be cordial. Be civil. Be respectful. Show your children that you can talk across the aisle and that that it's important to have FaceTime with your lawmakers. So that's just like my little plug. So they did that. And she mentioned that she'd been a journalism teacher at one time. And I thought, journalism, that sounds interesting, And I think that was kind of the first time I thought, well, that's something that maybe I should think about, because I always loved to write and, write little stories and poems and stuff as a kid. But it seemed like a way to actually make money writing. And so that was kind of, I think, the first seed. But my father, I have to credit, set up a meeting for me with an editor at the Kansas City Star. There was a teen section back in the day. And
yes.
So I started writing for them. And it just kind of one thing led to another, I guess.
At some point, then, you went off to NPR member stations in Georgia, Iowa, and Nebraska. How did you get to public radio?
So I kind of started down the print path, I thought. And I did that briefly. I went to college in the Chicago area, interned for a newspaper up there, and then wound up getting hired by the newspaper in the Chicago suburbs. And really loved newspaper journalism, and I always will. But also was spending a lot of time in my car listening to public radio, mostly because I'd tried listening to like Top 40 and books on it was books on CD back in that day, and kind of was just feeling like I was waste. I mean, books on CD are great, but like I wanted something that was a little more sort of what's going on now. And so I thought, well, I guess I could listen to NPR. You know, like I wasn't a huge NPR fan at the time, but I got hooked really fast, and it became my constant companion in the car. All this commuting in Chicago traffic, I started opening every conversation with my husband with, you know, I heard this on NPR, and I kind of started thinking like, I'm launching a journalism career. Maybe this is the direction I should actually try to go. And so after about a year of that, I followed my husband to Nebraska for his graduate program, and thankfully, one of those things, I don't know if it was God, I don't know if it was luck, I don't know if it was just coincidence, whatever you want to call it, it was a job opened up just right as I was moving to Nebraska.
In Lincoln?
In Lincoln, and there weren't very many jobs at that station, and they were willing to take a chance on a pretty green print reporter who didn't know anything about radio. So from there, I just kind of kept trying to build skills and get better at radio and learn how to mix, you know, mix in digital audio form and all that stuff. Just started doing hosting. Really just tried to learn as many skills as I can and kept kind of, you know, building a career as you do.
You know, it's interesting because you've said that your upbringing helped you in your reporting when you were on the presidential campaign trail with Donald Trump and in places like Iowa and near where you had once worked. How so?
Yeah, I mean, I'm when I cover Republican politics, I'm struck by how much people use their faith to explain how they what they believe or why, or even just as part of their language.
Right.
You know, I think I'm sure plenty of people listening are people of faith, and even if you're not, you might have noticed. You know, for people who are deeply religious, it's such a part of their identity and how they think about the world and how they make sense of the world. I did a story from a big candidate forum in, I think, in Des Moines in 2015, and this was around the time that the debate over refugees was really heating up, and you know, obviously President Trump's and then candidate Trump's position on refugees was not especially friendly to helping refugees, and there was a lot of discussion within the religious community, especially evangelicals, about what does our faith teach about this, and you know, there are so many Bible verses that you can quote about welcoming the stranger, and so there was kind of a robust debate going on, and I remember interviewing people at this forum about it and hearing different perspectives. But so many times people just mixed in scripture into their, you know, just quoting Bible verses. And it was the really interesting thing when I go back and listen to this piece is how, and the really tricky thing I think about religion and making sense of it is that people can often find a verse to support
anything.
Arguably support anything. Yeah. And that's a whole other conversation about what's good exegesis and hermeneutics, which we won't have right now, but you do hear people cite scripture in our political public sphere to support a whole range of views, and usually it's Christian scripture, but I'm sure you could do it with other religious texts as well. So it's fascinating, but it's helpful to be fluent in some of that, to understand where they're coming from and what they mean,
and to connect with people in some ways too.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, was covering Trump, I mean, the helter skelter experience that you're sort of led to believe it was, and he's such a shoot from the hip kind of guy, that covering him, I think, having covered a lot of campaigns, must have been different than lots of other presidential campaigns. We haven't seen anything quite like it before.
Right. Oh, it was. It was very helter-skelter. I was hired to cover the Republican primary, so I also spent a fair amount of time with Carly Fiorina and Ben Carson and Ted Cruz and, you know, the other 4,700 candidates that ran that year. And the Trump campaign was a very different experience. I mean, I always contrast it with Ted Cruz because I probably spent the most time with him, of course, Texas Senator Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
Because he was, you know, he was one of the sort of top tier candidates in that primary. And you know, his staff was very organized. They would send you press releases. They would send you, you know, agendas, and you could call them up and ask them, where are we going tomorrow? And it wasn't too difficult. But then when I started to switch over to covering Trump on a regular basis, it was, you know, it's much more chaotic. And
did they even know where they were going tomorrow?
Sometimes no. I remember one time desperately texting Hope Hicks to say, you know, look, I'm a mom. I have two little kids I haven't seen in days. Can you just tell me where we're going or if I can fly home for a couple of days? But it was, I think that was part of the appeal for a lot of voters, was just that this was this not a political a veteran sort of shoot from the hip. A lot of voters I talked to saw Trump as very authentic and very real. And they liked that outsiderness. Whether or not it was convenient for us as reporters to cover him is another question.
Right. What kind of access did you get to him during the campaign?
Not great.
Not great.
We asked for interviews with Trump repeatedly. And still, to my knowledge, he has not given NPR an interview. We've made the offer. I think that for a president who so often attacks the press and accuses the press in general of promulgating fake news, you know, if you have an opportunity to speak directly to millions of people, you should take it. And I wish that he would. But so far, he has not.
You know, I've done just enough presidential campaign reporting to know how utterly exhausting it is, 4 a.m. bag checks and all this sort of stuff. How did you manage it? And what are those days like as a reporter on the campaign of a major candidate?
Yeah, it is exhausting. It's also, yeah. I mean, it's like a roller coaster. And
yes.
I've described it before as like a bad relationship or something, because you know, when you're in it, you're just so exhausted and miserable.
Yes.
And then the second it's over, you're like, I miss it. You know, what now?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a lot of long hours. It's a lot of some of it is, I think the thing I was least prepared for was just how physically rigorous it is. You know, how sometimes it's difficult to even have time to eat or sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
You know, especially when during the primary time when Trump was going from like, you know, little city to little city. So you'd have to, in order to get from like Huntsville, Alabama to Charleston, South Carolina or something, just for example, you know, you'd have to hop like four flights because you've got to catch a connecting and then another connecting. And and so you're trying to squeeze that in in a 24-hour cycle along with filing stories. And it's intense. And I think a lot of us on that campaign team have talked about it since, how much we didn't realize how much we would need to decompress and take care of ourselves after.
I get that. You know, I want to go to some of the stories you've been covering lately. And when you go there, you automatically go to abortion. You've covered the abortion story in Missouri and across the country. Why did that story explode the way it did, with so many state legislatures tackling that issue this year? What happened out there?
Well, in short, it's because of the Supreme Court. And I remember, I mean, I think back to the Trump campaign when I think about this question, because when I was covering Trump and I was asking the question that I get asked so often of conservative, often religious voters, why they were supporting Trump, so many of them would say it was because of the Supreme Court and abortion or issues like religious liberty. The Supreme Court came up again and again and again, and usually that's code for abortion and other a few other issues.
Mm-hmm.
So I just remember I was filling in at the White House, you know, last summer. I was in the NPR newsroom, and the day that the news came out that Justice Kennedy was retiring, I stood up at my desk and I said, "Okay, we've got to get ready for an abortion fight," because I knew that that would be the next step, and it really has. I mean, the court has now moved to the right with the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, and abortion rights opponents see an opportunity to restrict abortion rights that they haven't seen in a generation. So
here they come in state legislatures.
Yes, yes. And at the same time, abortion rights advocates are trying to push in the other direction. A few states have passed laws basically putting, you know, codifying Roe v. Wade into state law with the idea that if Roe v. Wade falls or is, you know, deeply eroded, those protections would be in state law. So it's going to be a really interesting battle over the next couple of years.
You know, we've just got a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to ask you about a recent story you've covered that caught my eye and ear, and maybe it will our listeners too. This story had the headline, "When Your Wedding Night Is Your First Time." And it focused on Laura and Adam Harden, who live in a Washington, D.C. suburb. The obvious question, how did you get Laura and Adam Harden to talk to you on tape for a national audience about something that sensitive?
That personal?
I mean, man.
Yeah. They.
Ouch.
So All Things Considered was doing a series on sex, and we kind of ran the gamut talking about, you know, queer sex and kink and all kinds of things that maybe you don't always hear on NPR. and they also wanted to do one on sort of more traditional conservative approaches. So they came to me, you know, knowing that I sort of understand that culture and would do it sensitively. And so I just reached out to a lot of people I know and said, "Who do you know?" And I actually had three different couples willing to talk to me who were all amazing. And I pre-interviewed them all. And we went with Adam and Laura partly because they were close and because they were just I thought they were lovely people.
The story just had all of that in it. I still couldn't believe they talked to you about it.
Yeah. They, you know, I think they said one of the things is there's been a lot of criticism of purity culture, people who feel hurt by it. And they said, you know, they were fortunate that they had a religious community that was open and really willing to discuss sex. And they want that for other people in their community. So that's part of why they chose to talk to me. And I appreciated that.
Well, that's NPR's Sarah McCammon. She's in town for KCUR's Radio Active Gala tonight down at the Sheridan. Thanks so much for your time. So glad you're here.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, we revisit our conversations with the two candidates for Kansas City mayor. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. Yesterday on the program, the USDA announced a major move bringing two research agencies to Kansas City. Hear what that means for the city at kcur.org/up-to-date. Next week, Kansas City municipal elections are on Tuesday. Be sure to join us on Wednesday for a post-election wrap-up and analysis. That's next week on KCUR's Up to Date. When it comes to the two candidates for mayor of Kansas City, Jolie Justice and Quentin Lucas, there are similarities. Both are current council members, both are attorneys, and both are in good standing with many residents of the city. So what do they want to do if they become mayor? Well, Up to Date took its individual interviews with each candidate and rolled them into one. Brian Ellison spoke with Ms. Justice, and I talked with Mr. Lucas on subjects ranging from affordable housing to transportation to violent crime. In a final run-up to Tuesday's election, here are those interview highlights. Brian gets us started.
Your opponent, Quentin Lucas, has made affordable housing a centerpiece of his campaign. He's the chair of the council's housing committee. You've been critical in some of the forums up till now that more hasn't been done to create affordable housing. Let me ask you specifically, what would you do to create more affordable housing in the city? Specific programs.
Specific programming would start with the issue of what we're already doing, which is a focused development of neighborhoods. I love what they're doing, for instance, in the Likens neighborhood right now, to take vacant and abandoned properties, use pro bono lawyers to get them back onto the tax rolls by suing out-of-state folks who are letting these properties go to waste, and then working with public-private partnerships to rehab the houses and get people back in them. They say there are over 9,000 vacant and abandoned properties right now. We need to make sure that we are getting those properties back on the tax rolls and people living in them. So that's one. That's the preservation piece.
Sure.
On the creation piece, we need to immediately not just talk about it anymore. We need to get an ordinance passed that sets aside affordable housing requirements for all the new developments that are coming through. And that's something that was passed out of Councilman Lucas's committee on February the 6th. It has sat on the floor since that time. And unfortunately, it's been sent back to committee because we still are waiting for answers. We don't know what we're waiting for. We just know that it is out there. We have the opportunity to do it. We need to move that forward now.
And why is that not moving forward? You're waiting for answers. I don't understand what that
means. Well, that's a very good question, and one that unfortunately, you're going to have to ask my opponent, because we were asked that question in a debate 2 weeks ago, and he said that he was waiting to get additional information about making sure that we don't get into a scenario where we are working against people who are trying to build duplexes and fourplexes and sixplexes. And that's fine. If that's just an amendment, we can write it on the floor. But when the actual bill came up to a vote, I guess it was 2 weeks ago now, and we asked the questions, Councilman Lucas wasn't there, and we were not able to move it forward. And so I want to know what the holdup is.
She says that your affordable housing agenda has stalled in a number of key places, and you haven't done enough to get that policy through. That's an example, she
says. Sure. I mean, I kind of get her criticism, although I think if she was interested in affordable housing, then I would ask the question of why has she not been to a single housing committee meeting during her 4 years on city council?
Mm-hmm.
We'd love her help. I introduced and personally wrote, I've now probably written about 12 pieces of legislation relating to housing and affordable housing and the creation of more affordable housing in Kansas City. The particular piece of legislation she's talking about, I've been working with lawyers from Legal Aid of Western Missouri, the Urban Neighborhood Initiative, and Diane Cleaver, and others to make sure that we actually get the piece of legislation right. It's not being held up. We're actually trying to get something impactful done. So it's not just one of those ordinances or resolutions that we pass too often at City Hall. We're nothing happens and nothing improves, but instead to be something really substantive. I am darn proud of the work I've done in the housing arena. I think it's more than we've seen in several decades. I had a conversation actually with former mayor and Congressman Emanuel Cleaver about it just this weekend, about how we're doing a lot of good work now, how we have more work to do, and frankly, how we all should be proud of the progress we've made for the first time in probably 30 years. So I think that attack misses the mark, like many of the rest of them. I would prefer, I'm happy to talk about the substance of it, but these sorts of procedural attacks really do reflect the politics of somewhere else and nothing related to solving the problems of Kansas City.
In a nutshell, what's your plan for reform, if any, of the way we do TIFs and other incentives?
I think that economic and development incentive reform is absolutely critical and something that we do need to talk about. Because while these tools are incredibly important, and we would not have seen some of the success that we've seen, whether it's putting in a new grocery store at 31st and Prospect, or whether it's revitalizing our downtown, we would not have seen those things without these incentives. And so I have always been a legislator, both at the state level and at the city level, who takes every request on a case-by-case basis. And one of the things that I found is that the first question I always ask is, what is the public benefit? And if there's not one, then the answer is no. There is no incentive that we're going to push forward. So how do we make sure that we're now using those incentives to really have a catalytic effect in neighborhoods that have been left behind or have been, you know, on the outside of some of these amazing developments that we've seen? And the way that we do that is twofold. We get much more intentional and focused on the neighborhood piece. And so we work with the EDC to start going out and recruiting people to specifically look at neighborhoods. We talk about putting in more community benefits agreements and development agreements to make sure that we're getting a really big bang for our buck. That means putting local people to work on the projects. That means making sure that we're focusing on transportation and housing, which are two critical issues. And then, of course, the other thing is making sure that the boards and commissions that are making these decisions have stakeholders that have a really, really invested interest in making sure that we get this right. And so my commitment is to make sure that all of those boards and commissions are populated by people who know what's important for the city.
So I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. I hear you saying that you would still support the use of these incentives throughout the city, but am I hearing you say that you want to see them used in different parts of the city than they have mostly been used in?
That is correct. I want to use our incentives in parts of the city that have not seen the same level of investment. And I also want
downtown, like Power and Light.
We have obviously seen a tremendous amount of use of incentives in our downtown core, and that has been vital because the downtown core is essentially the center of the city, and 25% of our economy comes from downtown.
But have we had enough?
You know, you'll never be able to get me to say we've had enough, because if someone came forward tomorrow and said we've got this fantastic opportunity to put in a brand new opportunity for job creation, for educational opportunities on the east side of downtown, I would hate to have said that we're done and that we don't have those tools available.
Not a moratorium.
No moratorium. I want to start using the incentives in more creative ways.
You hear it more and more these days that Kansas Citians are starting to say, we're taxed enough. We don't want to do it anymore. You just suggested that perhaps if the right plan could get your support for an early childhood thing. Are there other initiatives out there that you'd be willing to raise taxes for?
No. No, I am one of those who believes that we have gone to the well quite a bit lately.
Mm-hmm. Even for affordable housing, one of your key issues.
I think the world of affordable housing, and I think it's important, and I think it's a key issue as someone who grew up experiencing homelessness myself. That being said, the voters have approved a lot of taxes to help support that issue. We have an 8-cent sales tax, the Central City Economic Development sales tax, for which housing can be one use. I was criticized by my opponent for saying that perhaps we want to see how we can support more multifamily development projects and single family on the east side of Kansas City from that tax. I think that's actually just smart. It's $10 million a year we're generating. Let's try to get some of that money to make sure we're retaining residents in the east side of Kansas City, Missouri.
But you're also on a city council that's approved a resolution saying it needs a $75 million housing trust fund.
I wrote that.
And that trust fund has got exactly $0 in it right now. So how do you get the money for that?
Oh, I'm delighted to talk about that. I think there are a few different ways to get it. Right now, so I've already identified that you have your $10 million east side fund, which, frankly, I think there can be a percentage of that that goes to help support affordable housing development. We'll go through the same process. We have to bring projects projects, all of that. But I think that could be a helpful thing that will build opportunities on the east side. At 27th and Prospect, we just built a multifamily development near the Morningstar Missionary Baptist Church.
That's still a long way from $75 million.
Though. That's still a long way, but you know, how do you get to $75 million? A dollar at a time. You know, another way you do it too is, I mean, and I understand we're gonna have to add funds together. I think we also have to look to our annual allotment from HUD. We get $8 million a year from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. How do we spend it? I think it's fair to critique it and say not always that well. This year there were proposals for up to $800,000 of parking lots. We don't need to spend housing money on parking lots. I think you start to add it up through there, and that's how you do it. What I don't think we do is just say, hey, let's go for another tax increase, another fund, and much like we've seen with GO bonds, then start this fight for how people can spend the money incorrectly, frankly.
Jolie Justice wants to create something called a City Department of Transportation to oversee streets and ridding the city of potholes. What do you think of that idea?
I don't understand why we're going to duplicate what already exists at City Hall. If any of you go to the Department of Public Works website today, their job is basically roads, bridges, right, pedestrian trails, right, in the city to make sure
traffic
moves.
So we've already got it.
We've got it. We've got a Department of Transportation. It is called, right, in essence, the Public Works Department. We work with Ride KC and the KCATA. We have a planning department. The way to fix those problems of having different silos at City Hall is not to create a new unfunded silo. The idea is we need to actually just do a better job with what we've got. We don't need a new Department of Transportation. We don't need new bureaucracy. When we're talking about how we better plan for our road infrastructure for the future, the idea there needs to be that Public Works needs to do what we promised we would do when we passed the GO bonds. We need to only invest, right, with GO bond money into existing roads. We did not do that. Councilwoman Justice supported a $9 million Road to Nowhere effort, which is a new road to a speculative development project in the Northland of Kansas City that doesn't even connect at another end. So we're building kind of a one-way road for $9 million, which is money that should have gone to repair streets like Warnell, like Gregory, like North Oak Traffic Way that wasn't done this year. So, yeah, Department of Transportation, intriguing idea. But what we really need to do is make sure the Department of Public Works actually works and make sure we're delivering services at City Hall before just adding more bureaucrats.
Give us a little preview. If you were holding the first meeting of the Department of Transportation and giving them their marching orders, what is it that needs to happen right now to address the city's transportation needs?
Cities that moved and have moved in this direction have seen an increase in mobility across the board, which is obviously critically important when we're talking about our most vulnerable citizens. It is helping move people to work, to school, to housing opportunities that we have not seen in the past because you are finally all starting from the same playbook. So here's our big problem right now. We have the Parks Department that is in charge of both planning and constructing streets. We've got Public Works. We've got the Water Department that from time to time needs to interfere with the movement around the city. We've got our utilities. We've got the City Manager's Office. We've got the KCATA and the Streetcar Authority. All of these different entities are trying to address our transportation issues. And we don't have right now a plan other than communicating, you know, through emails that really looks at the long-term strategy of what we're going to do. We've got a great Public Works Department. We've got a great planning department. We should not be asking them to do each other's jobs. What we need to do is work forward in a really coordinated way that says, this is the next big project we're going to be doing. And I'm not talking about creating a new bureaucracy. I'm not talking about bringing in the KCATA or the Streetcar Authority under City Hall. That's not what I'm proposing. Instead, what I'm proposing is let's have someone who at the end of the day, the buck stops with them mm-hmm. and is able to present to Kansas City, Missouri residents what our plans are, which streets are going to be fixed, and when.
Why can't this city get its arms around the violent crime issue? What is it about Kansas City that's made this so intractable? Other communities, I'm thinking of New York City on the East Coast, Oakland on the West Coast, have had a lot more success. Why can't Kansas City get it straight?
You know, I'll say this as a first step. It is eerily easy. It's never been my life, but it's eerily easy to not see issues in a different neighborhood, to not know the full extent of it. And so I might suggest if your only relationship with violent crime is the first 2 or 3 minutes of the local news, then perhaps it doesn't seem to prevail upon your life in the same way that it does for someone else who's living closer to it. And so I think probably for us, a first key step is recognizing the real crisis that we're in, and recognizing and explaining how it has an impact in every neighborhood of Kansas City. The fact that drug traffickers are operating with impunity in some areas of our city, leading to violent crime, means that there's more drug trafficking in other parts of the city. It means that there will be more young people getting involved. I mean, that is a big step one. I think a step two does relate to the space of our city.
We're even spread out.
Right, right. And so even if you are in an area that's dangerous, let's say the east zone of Kansas City Police Department, which runs from about Prospect on east in the city, you know, you can say, well, it wasn't next to me. And we need to spend a lot more time thinking about how much that is impacting us, the cost of violent crime on people, the cost of crime on the hopes of so many people, young people in particular in Kansas City.
So another of the issues that you mentioned up front as something that people ask you a lot of questions about is crime in the city. And I guess I'd like you to reflect a little bit on what exactly is the crime problem that Kansas City has. I think there's sort of this assumption in every race in every city for city government positions. Oh, yes, I'm going to be tough. I'm going to fight crime. I'm going to address the crime problem. What is the crime problem in Kansas City?
Well, I think that the biggest thing is our homicide rate. When you look at the fact that we are on a top 10 list for most homicides in the country, that is a place that we need to remove ourselves. What's interesting is that some of the work we have been doing both at the state and the local level is actually helping us see a decline in violent crime other than homicides. Mm. And so what we're going to have to do in order to address crime is not be tough on crime, because for decades, that's the approach both the state, the federal government have taken, and all it's resulted in is mass incarceration and communities that are devastated, and it disproportionately impacts Black and brown people. And that is something that I refuse to be a part of. And so for my 8 years down in Jefferson City, I focused on criminal justice reform. We saw a report out of the Vera Institute just 3 weeks ago now that Missouri's prison population is actually declining faster than any other state in the nation. And they pointed out the bills that I passed, the criminal code reform, the Justice Reinvestment Act. Those things are actually starting to make a difference. Now we have to make sure we are starting to come up with very specific deterrence opportunities to work on these specific homicide issues.
A lot of people would say that those are some concrete things you were able to do as a state senator. But the mayor is a different position. What as mayor can you actually do about crime? The police are controlled by a board that's appointed by state officials. What can you do?
Well, the first and foremost is the police is appointed by the police are run by a board, and the mayor sits on that board. So bringing that same concept of being smart on crime to the police board is very, very critical. I have seen over and over and over again, when we put our money into social services, when we put our money into smart policing, when we put our money into specialty courts and wraparound services, that's when we start to see a decline in crime. And so I will be sitting on that police board making those decisions. The other thing that is very unique about what I'm proposing, and it's not going to be cheap, but it's a conversation we have to have, is we need more neighborhood police officers. I'm not talking about the folks who are responding to calls throughout the day. Right now, our officers, 80 to 90% of their time is spent responding to calls. And so there's no time to build relationships within our community. As a police board member, I will be focusing on making sure that we shift to a place where we have two additional neighborhood officers per sector, that we keep our social worker program, which is already starting to make a difference, and that we also have a much more robust recruiting effort to make sure that our officers look like our community.
So the city already spends, 76-77% of its general fund on fire and police, general protection mm-hmm. kinds of services. So where do you go in terms of concrete steps forward? Do you got to hire more officers,
right,
more social workers, use the police differently? What's the Quentin Lucas plan here?
Yeah, the simple plan is this. One, in connection with the budget issue, you spend whatever you need to make sure that you're addressing the core issue, right? You spend what you need to make sure people are safe.
Is that more or less than we're spending now?
It may well be more, Steve. I think when we look at the budget right now, first of all, that 76% of the budget number comes from the general fund as compared to all of the other things that go into the city. Enterprise funds like the water department, aviation, dedicated taxes, et cetera. So that's not quite, you know, not three quarters of every dollar are going just to that. There are lots of other things that happen. But in terms of what we do, two words, resources and relationships. On the resources point, I do think we make sure that we're deploying police in a way that relates to neighborhood policing more on the community side. That would be giving officers the opportunity to spend more time in sectors of the city. A comparison would be for those.
I thought we were doing that already.
You know, we've invested in community interaction officers. I think with the idea that if you have an officer, one or two in each patrol division, they'll be the ones that get to talk to people. I want to see us get closer to that classic idea of a beat cop, right? For those who may remember that either from TV shows or knowing it in
the So relationships
life.
Get formed right. is where you're going
exactly.
here, right?
You really do make sure relationships are formed. There is also, and it's not lost on me that I'd get to be a member of the Board of Police Commissioners, the idea of how is the police department spending that money that's coming in? If you look at the budget in the last year, there is it's eerily close percent amount of the budget that goes into the administrative bureau and the patrol bureau.
And again, I thought those numbers were changing with time. There's been news about that over the years,
right.
that we're going to get the administrative guys out back on the street again.
Right. They're supposed to be changing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we need to continue to push, because I think the patrol bureau, the folks that you and I see out and about every day, are the ones we need to see more of. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's important for an officer to be able to build up a relationship. I've now done three ride-alongs with the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. I'm not sure if my opponent's done any. And in those three ride-alongs, what I have seen is that often in the east zone or the center zone, you have an officer who's going from one scene, not a lot of time there to process. They're driving miles and miles to another spot, not a lot of time to process. And when you're talking about issues relating to interviewing a domestic violence victim or asking about criminal activity or drug activity in a neighborhood, you need that time. You need that investment in the community. You need that investment in detectives. And that's what I think we need more of.
Let me ask you one more question. Are you happy? You've had a chance as a council person to actually observe what's going on at City Hall pretty closely, more closely than most of us. Are you happy with the current administration of City Hall, the city manager, the departments, or do you think there'll be some things that you'll want to shake up there?
You know, it's one of those things when you're a city council person, you get a constituent call and you immediately kick into problem solving mode and you're very unhappy on one specific day with one thing that's happening. And so you want to try to fix it. And what I have seen is that we have an amazing city manager. We have an amazing set of city employees who are really doing a fantastic work. Are there things we need to address where we have dropped the ball? Oh, yeah. We've got a lot of work to do, but we've got some really interesting tools in place that I look forward to implementing to improve that performance. Our KC Stat program, it's been wonderful for the last 8 years. It's trying to take it to the next level and really use it to solve the systemic problems we've seen in some departments to make sure that citizens not only know that their problems are going to be addressed, but when they're going to be addressed. And we need to get that information much, much easier to the constituents. And so those will be focuses of my campaign as well.
There's a lot of speculation in this race that you want a new city manager. You apparently think that Troy Schulte hasn't done the job. Is that right?
No, that's absolutely incorrect, too. I mean, here's the deal. I'm running.
You keep him on a city manager.
I would keep him on a city manager. I'm running to make a difference and a positive impact on Kansas City. And frankly, I'm running to get things done. I think this city manager has an ability to do so. I disagree with some of the things the mayor has directed him to do. I disagree entirely with the airport process, which was a disaster. But at the same time, I actually think that the city manager knows a lot about the things I care about. How do we rehab more housing? How do we, instead of demolishing our community, invest more in preservation? How do we make sure we have a city that's safer? And that's the sort of work that I'll be doing. So no, it's not I'm coming in and changing ships. And one of the more laughable things I hear, Steve, is that one of those rumors being pushed around, they're saying, well, you're going to fire the city manager and replace him with Catherine Shields.
And I've heard that.
And, you know, I think the world of Catherine, but, you know, I think if Catherine was the city manager, I would become the least important and the least powerful mayor in the history of Kansas City, Missouri. And so
she's good at doing that. Yes,
good.
Yes, she is.
And
she knows how to lead. Yeah.
It's my view that, no, I think I look forward to working with Troy. I think we have a lot of good things to do, but I think we need to reorient our focus to momentum being shared in all neighborhoods of Kansas City, not just a few.
That was highlights from our interviews with the candidates for mayor of Kansas City, Missouri. Yesterday on the program, professors discussed the ethical and constitutional questions that come with abortion. Hear that and previous episodes at kcur.org/uptodate. Find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Monday on the program, the closing of the Cinemark Theater on the Plaza means one less place for teens to hang out this summer. What's being done to give kids some space? Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.